Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 78. I'm recording it on Friday, January 16th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 14, I think it is this morning. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is My Great Crime. I predicted the stock crash 12 years too soon. I like the intro music for this podcast. It's called A Little Boogie. That's the title, and it brings back happy memories. I used that music for the first time on the first podcast I did when we returned from our vacation in early September. We usually go on a family vacation to the beach in September. And in recent years, we had been going to Cape May, New Jersey, which we like. It's a Victorian beach town. And it's nice, but it's not perfect for kids because they only have a very tiny boardwalk there. So they don't have a lot of amusements. And when the boys were younger, they could go on the rides. They had a couple baby rides, but they're too big for that stuff. And so I wanted to take them to a real boardwalk. Like I grew up going to Wildwood, New Jersey, but Wildwood's gotten a little bit, a little too rough. It's extremely crowded. There's wonderful rides there, great rides, but little on the rowdy side compared to what it used to be. So this year, for the first time, we went to Ocean City, New Jersey. And I was nervous about it because the year before we didn't have such a great vacation, I didn't think. It didn't rain hard, but it was sort of threatening to rain the whole time. And so the beach time wasn't that great. And again, they didn't have the rides and it was sort of okay, but I didn't think it was really worth the money. But this year I was nervous and I held off going. We were going to go earlier in the year and I heard very bad reports about the ocean temperature. Something strange was going on this year, and the ocean temperature was very low, even in August. Too low to swim. And but everything just happened right for us. We went 5 days there in the early part of September, and everything was just perfect, and there were great waves to ride. A storm was coming in, and the waves were fantastic. And then the storm started the day we left, so we got like the perfect 5 days. And my boy had a blast; both of them did, but especially the older one. He was just completely exhausted at the end of the day. And the younger one wasn't too excited about going; he wanted to go to a water park instead. But I took him to a Star Wars movie, and he was happy. And just all the way around, everything worked. And so I got back home, and I was all psyched and feeling good and feeling feisty. And I put on that intro music, A Little Boogie, and I did some scat singing. And I was like, PassionSaving.com, you know, and all this sort of thing. And it was unusual. And my boy overheard me playing it back, and he says, "Dad, if you want people to take what you're saying about investing seriously, you can't do that. You can't do that sort of thing." I say, "Thank you, Timothy. Thank you for the tip." And the funny thing there is that my boy Timothy takes after his mother, I think, and you know, he's just, you know, just a happy, cheerful boy, but he's you know, normal. He likes things to make sense. And the younger boy is the one who takes after his dad, as stubborn as the day is long. You can't. I remember, I'll stop with this intro, but I'll explain why I do it after. But I the story I always remember about Robert is one time I was trying to get him to eat his peas, and you know, we weren't having any luck, and I finally got down to the end and I was like, look, you got to eat one pea, you know, at least give us something, give us some face-saving gesture, eat one pea. And we're all going to have chocolate ice cream. And if you eat the one pea, you know, you can have the chocolate ice cream. And if you don't, you can't have the chocolate ice cream. And, you know, Timothy's eyes are popping out. He's like, Robert, you know, this is a great deal. I mean, take that deal. And, you know, and I have the pea in a spoon, and I'm sort of lifted from his face, and he just, bam, you know, no pea. I'm not eating a pea. You know? So that's Robert. All right. So, yeah, you know, some people are going to look at that, and they're going to listen to this, and they're going to say, "Rob, that's not this is not investing. You haven't mentioned any numbers yet. You haven't mentioned the Sharpe ratio. Well, what about the Sharpe ratio, Rob? You're talking about your boys and the beach and chocolate ice cream, and where's the Sharpe ratio? You left that out." But I think my whole deal is that I believe that what's wrong with investing today, what's wrong with stock investing today in particular, is failure to look at the emotional side of the question, which I think is 70% of success in stock investing. So I'm going to include, you know, personal stories in my efforts to explain how stock investing works in the real world. I think that's part of the story. And it may seem like it's not, but it is. It puts things in a context, and it sets the right tone. And of course, some of these stories can be used to illustrate, you know, in a more direct way, points about investing. These intro stories I'm telling are not, they don't relate directly, but they do make the point that, you know, I am a human, And, you know, you are a human, and it's one human talking to another, and that doesn't come through in the investing literature. I'm sorry to say, it doesn't. The Sharpe ratio thing eats away at me. It was indexuniverse.com. I wrote an article for them on valuation-informed indexing, and the publisher loved it. And he said, I've got to go through the editorial guy. And the editorial guy had ties to the bogleheads.org board. And the editorial guy is like, you know, he comes up with 15 excuses. And I wasn't asking for money. This was free. You know, and I've had great reaction. I mean, there are people that hate valuation-informed indexing, to be sure, but there are people who love it to death. And so, you know, no charge, free article, publisher likes it, gets debate started. You got to give me that one. It gets debate started. So, you know, win, win, win. And the guy comes up with 15 excuses, and I respond to each one. You know, he asks all these questions, and I have lengthy responses and links and all this sort of thing, you know, backing up what I say. And then at the end, he says, well, you didn't discuss Sharpe ratio. So, he says, I have standards that I apply for what articles get in. And he says, and he basically said, you meet the standards. So, you know, I can't say you don't, but I need different standards for you, because you're talking about valuation-informed indexing. So there's a whole different set of standards. And the standard for valuation-informed indexing articles is it has to talk about the Sharpe ratio. Can't allow the article in unless it talks about the Sharpe ratio. So, you know, what's going on there? It's inhuman. It's not even enough. You know, I often say passive investing is irrational, or I say passive investing is insane, or, you know, you could say passive investing is non-profitable or doesn't work or something like that, but it goes beyond that. It's inhuman. And of course, it wasn't intended to be inhuman. It wasn't inhuman when it started. A lot of the passive investing ideas are some of the most important ideas ever put forward in the history of investing. John Bogle is Mr. Passive Investing, and he's the godfather of the rational investing approach, whether he likes the idea or not. That's what he is. His ideas are some of the bedrock ideas of the approach to investing that I describe on these podcasts and at the website. But he can't acknowledge that baby. He can't. And his supporters can't. And that's sad. And it is subhuman. I'm sorry, but it is. And I'm going to say it. And I don't say it to hurt their feelings. But it does have to be said. We need a national debate on investing. And, you know, we have to start with the words, I was wrong. Or, you know, if we're not quite able to say I was wrong, we need to start with the words, I'm not sure. I'm not sure would do the trick, because I'm not sure would start a national debate. And the national debate, it has to begin with, what did we get wrong? Because you can't move forward until you admit you got something wrong. And I like to think we've all suffered enough at this point in the proceedings that we can acknowledge that we got some things wrong. But it hasn't quite happened yet. We've seen signs since the stock crash. We're seeing signs. But we're not there yet. And so every day is another day, and we just have to try again. And I think a big part of it is, you know, not being legalistic and being angry and, you know, making arguments and attacking and exploiting. You know, they love that word, exploiting. Passive investors. If there were some error, if somebody didn't know everything about investing and they made a mistake, then others would swoop in and exploit that mistake. See, that's the mindset. That's what I call the passive investing mindset. The reason you can't beat the market is because there's all these sharks out there waiting to exploit any mistake. So the market price is perfect, because if there were any imperfections, somebody would have exploited it by now. Well, that's not my experience of my fellow humans. There are sharks in the world. There are people that try to exploit mistakes. That's true. There are a lot of non-sharks, too. There are a lot of generous-spirited souls. There are a lot of kind souls. There are a lot of friendly souls. So the world is not as dark as painted by the passive investing enthusiast. And we need to let that in. But that's by way of preface, but it does relate. It's pulling us toward the topic of this particular podcast, number 78. The topic is, my great crime. I predicted the stock crash 12 years too soon. I got that from a thread at the Bogleheads.org board. So often that's the case. There's a thread. I don't know the title of it. It wasn't really about me, but I came into play. It was sort of comical. It was about some guy. I think the thread was called something like, who is he who may not be named? I believe that was the title of the thread. Who is he who may not be named? And I think, I couldn't follow it all. I think the reference was to a guy named Marketimer. And Marketimer is some guy there who relayed some story that was sort of incredible. And people thought he was a quote-unquote troll, that it was not a true story. It was too fantastic. And then one of the owners of the board checked out the story. I don't know how. Somehow. He checked things out and determined that the story, there was at least, you know, grounds to believe it was legitimate. So they didn't ban the guy, but there are people who think he should be banned. And so the guy was referring to him as he who may not be named. But somebody else saw the phrase he who may not be named, and they thought they were talking about me. And, you know, hocus. I started that board. I didn't start it in the sense that I didn't set aside the whatever you do to start a board, but they started it to escape me. I was committing the terrible crime of reporting the safe withdrawal rate accurately. Oh, no. Oh, no. And I was doing that at Vanguard Diehards, and they said, we can't, you know, what can we do? They tried to get me banned. I never did anything to justify a ban, and Morningstar wouldn't ban me, and they said, we've got to start a whole new board. We're going to leave Morningstar to escape this guy, Farmer Hocus. That's the birth of the Bogleheads.org forum, which is a good forum. It is a forum you should check out. I think it's the best resource on learning how stock investing works available to you today. I will say that. And I will go back and help build that board anytime I am permitted to. I love the people there, love the topic. Love the discussion board medium, love what they're doing. But not too crazy about the abusive posting. I could live without that. Not too crazy about the ban on honest posting, on valuations. Anyway, so they started talking about me. And, you know, one guy came in and he said, Oh, yeah, Hocus, yeah, remember that. And he says, one guy had a funny line. I thought it was funny. He said, he says, I can't remember anything that happened, but I know I was in favor of the ban. I can't remember anything that Hocus guy said, but I was in favor of banning him. I find some of these things amusing. I do think if you have to laugh so you don't cry. But another guy, the point of the podcast is another guy said, well, he was right, wasn't he? I was telling them there was going to be a stock crash. I was telling them, lower your stock allocation. There's going to be a stock crash. And they said, well, he was right, wasn't he? Or you know, and then a guy said, well, maybe he was right for the wrong reasons. I don't know what that means exactly, but, you know, I guess it makes them feel better to say I was right for the wrong reasons than just to say I was right. And then another guy says, yeah, he's probably laughing now, you know, that he was right, or especially if he's seen the thread. Somebody mentioned this. They said, especially if he saw the thread with Taylor, where Taylor admits that he's going to sell all his stocks if prices continue to drop. And I've talked about that a lot in the podcast. I wouldn't say I laugh about it exactly. I certainly I hope I don't feel any joy in other people's pain, but, I certainly think that Taylor's comments are a vindication of the rational investing model, of the flaws that I've pointed out in the passive investing model. So the guy said, "Oh, you know, he was right or whatever." And then some guy said, "Oh yeah, he was right. You know, he predicted the crash. Only thing is, he predicted it 12 years too soon." You know, so this is a sort of sarcastic comment. And that's what I want to talk about in this podcast. And it's all a question of perspective. All of these questions that have come up in the first 7 years of the great safe withdrawal rate debate, all of the questions that have come up are really questions of perspective. What I mean by that is there is no disagreement on the facts. The facts are what they are. And the advocates of passive investing, they don't really dispute the facts. They interpret them differently. And I, of course, say that they interpret them improperly. But the conflict comes from the fact that if I were disputing the facts, they could dismiss it. It wouldn't disturb them. If I were saying something different than what they're saying, they could sort of dismiss it. They could say, well, I don't know, let me think of an example. Somebody who follows a different investing philosophy. Somebody there who follows a different investing philosophy is a guy named Petrocelli. And Petrocelli, he's a good sense of humor, is one thing I like about him. He's not perfect. I don't agree with everything he says, but he does have a good sense of humor, which the passive investing dogmatists need in the worst way. And so Petrocelli is often a breath of fresh air when he shows up in the discussions. And Petrocelli follows something called momentum investing. That means when some segment of the market is going up, he moves more money into that segment on the theory that if once it goes up, it continues going up. And that's not passive investing. So he has a philosophy that is in conflict with theirs. Now, there are people that get very upset with Petrocelli. There are. So he does get a lot of the attacks. And I've defended Petrocelli when I used to post at Vanguard Diehards. Sometimes, you know, I definitely defended him on more than one occasion. But they haven't banned Petrocelli. And the reason they haven't banned him, I think, is he's different enough from what they're saying, from what they support, that he's not as big a threat as I am. he's got a different approach. You know, he uses index funds, I presume. But it's different enough that he's not seen as a super threat, although there are some who clearly do see him as a threat. But in my case, I don't do momentum investing any more than the passive investing enthusiasts do. In other words, we agree on so much that it's hard for them to counter what I say because, all the points that they can think of, all the criticisms they usually offer, you know, they'll say the standard criticism that they love, if anybody disagrees with them, is to say, well, we have historical data. We have historical data supports what we say. Well, see, I have historical data supports what I say. So that kills them. It's like their most powerful weapon is just taken out of their hands. The historical data weapon doesn't work. Even the Bogle weapon doesn't work. They love to say, well, we have John Bogle. We have John Bogle supports us. Well, John Bogle supports rational investing. John Bogle does support passive investing. It's true. That part is true. But he also supports rational investing. Both things are true. He supports both. He says, don't change your allocation in response to price changes. And he says that valuations affect long-term returns. That whenever prices are high, they're going to go down. And whenever prices are low, they're going to go up. Which is the whole reason why I believe in changing your stock allocation in response to price changes. So Bogle supports me. The historical data supports me. And that's what drives the passives crazy. So that's the point I want to, you know, highlight in this podcast. The guy, he's acknowledging that I predicted the stock crash. As I said, there's not really a disagreement on the facts. There's no question but that I predicted a stock crash. And I warned people. And there's, you know, they're acknowledging that. They're acknowledging the fact. But they can't acknowledge it in a good way. They can't say, well, good job, Hocus. Thanks for letting us know. We all saved lots of money because they banned me from their discussion board. So saying that I did a good thing would obviously not sound right. So, you know, what do you do in those circumstances? Well, what they do is they say, some of them don't try to be honest at all. Like, you know, there was a couple comments there that were not even honest. They just say that I said things I never said. That's, of course, just outright dishonesty. But the guy saying this thing about 12 years too soon was not being dishonest. He's making a legitimate point. He says, yeah, you know, Hocus, you know, predicted the stock crash 12 years too soon, 12 years early. What he means by that is, I took my money out of stocks in 1996, and the stock crash happened in, you know, 2008. So, I didn't, you know, what he's saying is, if I had come out, I don't know, the stock crash started prices started going down in late 2007. I don't know the exact dates, and of course things started going really bad in September 2008. So I guess what he's saying is if I had put out a statement January of 2008, you know, they have these looking ahead to the next year, you know, the famous stories that appear everywhere in every publication. And I had said in January of 2008, stock crash this year, better, you know, protect your portfolio, stock crash coming. They would have said, hey, this guy's onto something. This guy knows what he's talking about. He's a smart guy. Smart guy. And if I had said, and then if I could have said on top of that, well, in all the other, you know, in 96, I had said, keep your money in stocks. Stocks going up. In 97, keep your money in stocks. Stocks going up. And in 98, 99, I had said, keep your money in stocks. Stocks going up. And then in 2008, I said, maybe in 2000, I would have said, well, stocks, you know, not going to keep going up so much, but not going to go down all that much. You can do what you think, but it's not going to be a disaster. It's not going to be great. Great years are over. Not going to be a disaster. And same thing from 2000, say all the way through to 2008. And then in 2008, I said, get, you know, what? This is the year. Get your money out. That's the test that they are holding me to. They're saying, if you can't predict the stock crash within a year, we're not interested in your predictions. No, they're no good. That's what the guy's saying. Excuse me. Well, if that's the test, I fail the test because I can't predict what stocks are going to do in the next year. I believe in the saying that the Bogleheads have. They have a saying about short-term stock predictions. I don't know, and I don't care. I don't know, and I don't care. So what this guy is asking me to do is something I've never tried to do, have no interest in doing, don't believe can be done. I think it's a waste of human energy to try. So I'm never going to meet this guy's test. But here's the thing. Why is that the test? Why is it so important to this fellow? And it's not just him. You know, it's obviously lots of people feel this way. The passive investing enthusiast. They all feel this way to a greater or lesser extent. Why is it so important to them that someone who advocates rational investing be able to predict the market in the next year? Why? What difference does it make? If you can predict it in time and time enough, you know, for you to get your money out and protect your portfolio, what difference does it make that you'd be able to predict it in the next year? Why does it matter? I predicted it in 1996. That's when I took my money out. If you want to go by the rational investing school of thought, you would have predicted it in 1995. I mean, I didn't have any, you know, I've been developing this sort of as I go. You know, I've been reading and learning and discussing, and I hadn't quote-unquote predicted it in 1995 because I just hadn't gotten around to it yet. I was still reading John Bogle's book. But by 1996, I don't know when it was I took my money out. I believe it was the summer of 96. I'm not certain. So I quote-unquote predicted it in the summer of 96. But if I had known about rational investing in 1995, if I had known enough about it to make a quote prediction, I would have predicted it in early 1995. That's when prices went to insane levels. And this guy's saying, if that's all you can do is predict it, you know, 13 years too soon, not interested in what you have to say. Won't listen to what you have to say. Will ban anyone else who wants to listen to what you say from hearing your message. No one should ever hear what someone says who can only predict the market 12 or 13 years in advance. That's just not good enough. And, you know, Mel Lindauer used to say it's dangerous to let people hear this guy. This is dangerous. He's predicting things 12 years in advance? Can't allow that. What's so bad about predicting something 12 years in advance? Now, calculators are great tools. If you want to truly understand what I'm talking about here, I encourage you to go to the website and check out the Scenario Surfer, the calculator. And what that calculator lets you do is to, it goes through a 30-year sequence of returns. The returns are, in one sense, random, and in one sense, not. They're random in that they follow all sorts of different patterns. Each time you run the calculator, it'll be a different return pattern. But the returns, there are formulas built in to make the returns realistic, so that the stocks perform in the calculator similar to the way they perform in real life. They're not totally random, because returns in real life are not totally random. And then each year you get to choose a stock allocation. You can leave your stock allocation the same, and usually I do when I'm running it. I might stick with the same stock allocation for 10 years or 12 years. But every now and then, prices get so out of whack, you have to make a change because of your prediction that there's going to be a stock crash. And then at the end of 30 years, you get to compare the size of your portfolio with the size of the portfolio of people who followed rebalancing strategies. We have built into the calculator, we always report the results for 20% rebalancing, 50% rebalancing, and 80% rebalancing. And almost every time you use the calculator, close to 90%, I don't know precisely, but the vast majority of times you use it, valuation-informed indexing wins, and it often wins by a large amount. 80% rebalancing is almost always the second best choice, and 50% is almost always third best, and 20% is almost always the worst. So, the point here is, knowing what stocks are going to do 10 years in advance is a huge benefit. It at the end of 30 years, we're all going to be investing for 30 years, right? We're not investing only for 1 year. We're investing for, you know, if you start investing at 25, you're not going to retire till 65. That's 40 years. And you're probably going to live until, say, 85. So from 25 to 85 is 60 years. The investing lifespan is something close to 60 years, not 1 year. What difference does it make whether I can predict what the market's going to do on January of 2008, or whether the only prediction I can offer is a prediction that goes back to 1995 or 1996. What difference does it make? If the predictions work, and they do, there's never been a time in the history of the U.S. market when this approach to predicting predicting the future hasn't worked. It's always worked. And common sense tells us it always must work. It's not possible for the human mind to imagine a scenario in which this would stop working because the price that you pay for an asset always affects the long-term value proposition. So obviously, when you're paying three times fair value for a share of the S&P index, you're going to get a far worse long-term result than when you're paying fair value. I mean, is that controversial? It is. In the investing field, it's controversial because it goes directly against passive investing. It goes directly against all of the conventional wisdom that you've heard for the past 30 years. But yet, it's the most simple ABC common sense concept that could be put forward. So my question is, what do we have to do so that people stop looking for short-term predictions, which are impossible, which don't work, which just cause you to lose money, which are just market noise, Bogle calls them? How can we get people to stop looking for short-term predictions and instead take all that mental energy that these people are devoting to trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next year? And there's thousands of articles, what's going to happen in 2009? You can't even count them all. There's so many. And they're all gibberish, as far as I can tell. No one knows is the answer. No one knows. So if they don't know, why don't we stop reading about it? Stop wasting our time. But we do know what stocks are going to do over the next 10 years. That we know. Or we can know it if we just bother to look at it. If we bother to look at the question, we know. It's there. It's in the calculators, it's in the historical data, it's in the articles at the site. It's in the research at John Walter Russell's site. It's in Shiller's book. But we can't talk about it because it makes the people looking for short-term predictions, it makes their tummies feel funny. It makes their tummies feel funny because they're wasting their time. They're doing the wrong thing. And all we need to do to open this magic box of wonderful investing insights is to acknowledge that it was a waste of time to be focused on the short term, and that all along we should have been focused on the long term, because it's the long term that matters, and it's the long term that is predictable. And the short term doesn't matter, and the short term is not predictable. Historically, well, I want to mention this pet peeve of mine. Robert Shiller is the towering figure here. It's his book, Irrational Exuberance, that explains. You know, my work is basically I take Shiller's insights and turn them into practical, actionable steps for the investor. Shiller is an academic, and he tends to write theory. And the theory is just wonderful. It changes the history of investing. His book, Irrational Exuberance, is the most important book ever published on investing. But he doesn't anywhere in the book tell you how to manage your portfolio. He doesn't see that as his job. And so, you know, Rob Bennett came along, dum-de-dum-dum, and said, well, maybe somebody should do this. You know, maybe somebody should take these insights and turn them into actionable, you know, investing steps. How to achieve financial freedom early in life. So, dum-de-dum-dum, I did it. And, but when Shiller, you know, run a Google on him. And you know, he gets mentioned in the press all the time. And when his name comes up, they always have to describe who you are. You know, they mention a person, they have to say who he is. And I don't know how many times I've read a sentence along these lines. They'll say, Robert Shiller, who predicted the stock crash of 2000, or the stock downturn, because the NASDAQ, you know, crashed. The S&P went down, but it didn't crash as hard. But the NASDAQ did. They call it the tech stock crash or something like that. They'll say, Robert Shiller, who predicted the tech stock crash of 2000. He did no such thing. Or he did, but not in the way they're saying. He certainly predicted the tech stock crash, yes, just like I predicted the S&P crash. He predicted it years before it happened. He gave his testimony to the Federal Reserve in 1996. That's not when the crash happened. What they're saying is he predicted it because his book came out in March of 2000. The book just happened to come out then. Shiller didn't plan it. He didn't know when the tech stock crash was coming, any more than I knew when the S&P stock crash was coming. But yes, he predicted it, but he predicted it in the long term. He said in 1996, if you own stocks today, you're going to regret it within the next 10 years. He didn't say you're going to start regretting it on March 3rd, 2000. He didn't know, and he didn't care. The change we need to see in stock investing is we need a change from short-term thinking to long-term thinking. There's a phrase I use. When people distort things and present things in crazy ways, I'll say, that's the passive investing mindset talking. The passive investing mindset is another way of saying short-term thinking. Passive investing is a short-term strategy. Now, this is where you get into this difference of perspective that causes all this friction. Bogle doesn't call passive investing short-term. He calls it long-term. And the same thing with all the passive investing dogmatists. Ask them whether they're short-term or long-term, and they'll say, oh, long-term, long-term, long-term. But get into a discussion with them about predictions, and you get this kind of comment that I got on Bogleheads that, my great crime is that I predicted the stock crash 12 years too soon. Is that short-term thinking or long-term thinking? The guy acknowledges I predicted it. And anyone with any sense understands why it was good to know it was coming, because you could have gotten your money out of stocks and saved yourself, you know, a whole big bunch of heartache. But it's a terrible crime that I didn't do it in the year that it happened. I did it before. I gave people years to prepare. This comes up in 100 different ways. One of the ways it comes up is they'll talk about fees. You know, they'll say, oh, you know, there was a guy, Norbert Schenkler. He's a part owner of the Financial Webring Forum, and he started a thread there one time showing these charts on how valuation-informed indexing has always beaten passive investing through the history of the market. And he shows it graphically. And somebody says, oh, I think it was Schroeder. Oh, that doesn't count the fees. You got to look at the fees. There are fees involved. I don't think there are any fees involved. It of course, depends on how you implement it, but there's no reason for fees to be a problem. Passive investors rebalance their portfolios. There are fees involved in that. They're selling and buying. There are fees involved. Evaluation-informed indexers don't have to rebalance. So they save themselves fees. Now, we do change our allocations. And there are fees involved in that. But we do this so rarely that the fees are trivial. I did a test one time to see how often you had to change your stock allocation to implement valuation-informed indexing effectively, and it was not a scientific test. I went through some runs of the scenario so far. I didn't do enough to generate anything statistically meaningful, but it was just for my own amusement. Well, I was planning on doing an article, and I got caught up in other things. I never wrote the article, so someday I'll go back to it, and I'll do a more scientific test. But in the test I did, I can't remember how many times I ran the surfer, but I ran it enough times just to get a feel for it. And I was trying to do as few changes in allocation as possible while still having the strategy work. And with that thought in mind, I was able to get valuation-informed indexing to beat rebalancing by a big margin with one change in allocation every 13 years. I think it was every 13.5 years, but let's say 13 years. So you don't have to change your allocation very often for this magic to happen. Now, I wouldn't recommend that. There is no time period. It depends on the valuation level. But I would say in ordinary circumstances, you might want to make an allocation change on average every 8 years. In other words, you might go 15 years without a change, and then you might have to make two changes within the course of, 4 years. You don't know how much valuations are going to change, so there is no set number. But just look at recent history. From 1975 through 1995, stocks offered a strong long-term value proposition. So you didn't need to make one change for 20 years. You were set. Go with a high stock allocation in 75 and stick to it until 95. How many fees are you going to incur with 20 years of no changes? And you didn't need to rebalance either. Because when stocks get to insane prices, rebalancing sort of gives you the same benefit as valuation-informed indexing. It just gives a tiny bit. But if you're going to do valuation-informed indexing, you don't really need the rebalancing benefit. You don't have to worry about it. You're going to lower your allocation when prices become insanely dangerous. So you don't need to rebalance until that happens. So for 20 years, no rebalancing, no changes in allocation, no fees. In 95, you would have made a big change in your allocation because prices went to insanely dangerous levels. Surprise, surprise, you need to change your stock allocation when that happens. It's common sense. So in 95, you would have made a change. You didn't need to make another change until 2008. September of 2008, when prices crashed and the long-term value proposition became strong once again. So from 75 until 2008, you would have had two changes, a change in 95 and a change in 2008. That's 23 years, two allocation changes. See, that comes to about one every 11 or 12 years, which is about what happened in my test. That's the norm. But there could be times if it's possible we could enter a time like this now where valuation levels are going to change more frequently. In other words, we might drop down in the next few years to a valuation much lower. We might have another 50% drop. We don't know. It could be. And if that happened, you would probably want to change again. You'd want to increase your allocation a bit. So you'd have a third change, and then we might shoot up again, and you'd want to have a fourth change. So There could be time periods. There could be a 5-year time period where you would have two changes. But there's no need to change your, there's certainly no need to change your allocation every year. And on average, you probably need to do it every 8 or 10 years, something like that. Now, the problem is, so fees aren't the issue, but when people, when passive investing enthusiasts see this, they see that, here's what goes on psychologically. I'm not going to, you know, I'm always interested in what's going on a deep level, not the surface level where, you know, people talk, but people talk all, about all kinds of crazy things. I want to know what's really going on. What's going on is they see it and instantly see, I believe everyone has common sense. Not everyone, but most people have common sense. So anyone who believes in passive investing, which I say is insane, okay, I don't say that as an insult. I don't mean it as an insult. I don't say the people who follow it are insane. There are very smart people who follow passive investing. What I say is that the idea is insane. The idea that there's some asset out in the world where you don't need to change, you know, how much of it you buy based on price, I say that that idea is insane. It just cannot be. When people say market timing is impossible, I say that that idea is insane because market timing is just looking at price. And the idea that looking at price could be a bad thing is insane, in Rob Bennett's opinion. So, I sort of lost my thought there, but see if I can pull it back. But people are... I was saying that you don't need to make many allocation changes. And, I was saying the thought process. So I point out the benefits of valuation informed indexing. Maybe I show them one of these charts, you know, showing them that it has always worked through the history of the market. I point to the historical data. They have common sense. Everyone has common sense. If you adopt passive investing, you've got a conflict. An internal conflict from the first day. You've got common sense, which you can't give up. No one can give up their common sense. Totally. You can deny it. You can avoid it. You can ignore it, but you can't do away with it. So you've got common sense, and then you've got your passive investing beliefs, and the two are in conflict. One is telling you, lower your allocation, lower your allocation, lower your allocation. The other is saying, don't change your stock. Don't change your stock allocation. Don't change your stock allocation. Timing doesn't work. And the two are in conflict. And they're always in conflict because passive investing is the opposite of common sense. Common sense says you must change your stock allocation in response to price changes. Passive investing says you must not change your stock allocation in response to price changes. Both things can't be true. So you're always at war. You're always at war with yourself. And so what's happening is people see the evidence, and I present a mountain of evidence. There's evidence everywhere you turn. You know, we've got years and years of history, stock market history, showing that rational investing works and the passive investing cannot work. But you present that and they see it and they're like, oh my gosh, I made a mistake. And the cognitive dissonance kicks in and they say, gotta find a flaw, gotta escape this, gotta find a way out. Can't say I'm wrong. Oh, fees. You forgot the fees. Got a lot of fees. Changing your allocation. Oh, that causes fees. Got to pay fees. Doesn't work. No. I was right all along. Good point there. That was interesting, but I was right all along. But you weren't, because there are no fees. Or the fees are actually less than for those who follow passive investing. But, of course, once people get emotional and once they start shouting and once they start yelling, they can't calculate the fees. They're screaming. They're blind with rage. And don't think I'm exaggerating. Please check out the post archives of our discussions and you'll see it. So what I'm saying is what we need, we live in a twilight zone on the investing issue. We had the pre-Bogle era, which was, you know, people did the best they could. Some people invested well, some invested poorly. That was not, you know, it worked for many years, but it didn't work when we gave the middle class the responsibility of funding their own retirements, because in order to invest effectively in the pre-Bogle era, you had to spend a lot of time studying stocks, studying which ones to invest in. Bogle revolutionized investing. I call that earlier era. I think of it as the Buffett era. I mean, it obviously wasn't only Warren Buffett who was an effective investor, but all of his principles are sort of the pre-Bogle principles for how to invest. So if you want to know how to invest in the pre-Bogle era, study Warren Buffett, and you'll learn. Bogle developed an approach to investing for the middle-class investor, one where you don't have to study all these companies, you don't have to study annual reports and all that sort of thing. A simple way to invest that provides very good returns if implemented properly. That's indexing. That's the Bogle era. That's stage two. Bogle made a horrible mistake. The mistake was that he failed to consider the valuations factor. He just told people they could invest passively. They didn't need to change their allocation. It wasn't necessary. Shiller corrected the Bogle mistake. Shiller told us valuations do matter. Valuations do affect long-term returns. You must change your stock allocation. Passive investing cannot work. And now we've got all three. You know, what Rob Bennett did, for what it's worth, is I took Buffett and Bogle and Shiller and I mixed them all together in a blender and said, take the best ideas of all three and you've got something totally new. It's called rational investing. It makes sense. It works. It's always worked. It's hard for the human mind to imagine a case where it wouldn't work. And if we ever come up with something that if we find flaws in it, which we will, I'm certain, you know, that's the law of the universe. We're never going to get it perfect. We'll change it. If we're rational, we won't get dogmatic like the passive investors did. We'll just change it. We'll say, hey, made a mistake. Hopefully we will recognize it, you know, without too much time passing. And the key to that is getting community involvement, you know, doing it on discussion boards where people with different perspectives can all add their thoughts so that we'll discover our errors. We will not ban people, you know, because they point out our errors. We'll encourage them. We will say, please help us. Help us to learn. So that's all rational investing is. It's the combination. But the trouble we're having is we know what to do. You know, all the intellectual work we need to have a great approach to investing is there and to understand how investing works. All that work is done. But we've got this big hurdle of the passive investors are going to have to acknowledge they made a mistake. And that is a 10-foot high brick wall. That's a big obstacle. And all the experts, of course, have to acknowledge it. All the people who have advocated passive investing for 30 years now. And so the point of this podcast is the trouble we're running into is that rational investing in so many ways is very similar. It's based on many of the same principles, you know, that one of those principles that I think Bogle is responsible for putting forward is that short term doesn't matter. But you see, Bogle only went halfway. He was able to get the words out, short term doesn't matter. He got that part right. But by not requiring changes in stock allocation, he caused people to focus on the short term. When you're switching from a short term model to a long term model, you're changing everything about the investing project. Every single question needs to be re-examined. And Bogle didn't really make a transition from short term to long term. He changed the nomenclature. He said, let's go long term, but then by not requiring a change in allocation, he made it impossible for people to focus on the long term. Because see, in the long term, passive investing is always a failure. Passive investing's been tried. The passive slash emotional approach, it goes by different names, obviously. They don't always call it passive investing. But emotional investing is ignoring valuations. You know, just sticking with the same stock allocation, no matter how insanely dangerous prices get. That approach has been tried four times. It resulted in bone-crushing losses to everybody who followed it the first time, and it resulted in bone-crushing losses to everybody who followed it the second time. It resulted in bone-crushing losses to everybody who followed it the third time. It resulted in bone-crushing losses to everybody who followed it the fourth time. I'm beginning to detect a pattern. Passive investing cannot work. And if you look long term, which is what I advocate, and what Bogle at least, you know, nominally advocates, if you look long term, you see that. Of course, ignoring valuations is always going to result in bone-crushing losses. What would you think? What if we gave investing advice to people? What if we gave advice to people buying cars to say, never, ever, 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 ever look at price. You know, as a matter of fact, when you go to the dealer, tell them up front, say, look, I want to buy a car. I very, very badly want to buy a car from you, but I will not discuss price. I don't even want you to tell me the price. Just whatever price you charge, that's the price I'll pay. I will not look at price. I read a book, Cars for the Long Run. It said the worst thing you could do is to think about price. I read a book. It said negotiating price never works. Never works. Cannot work. What would happen? We would all be paying insane prices for our cars in a, you know, not that long a time. Well, that's what happened with stocks. Passive investing became popular. And once it became popular, we all started thinking market timing wasn't necessary. And we all, and not too long after that, we ended up paying insane prices for our stocks. And we destroyed our economy as a result. And I think we need to change that. But in order to change it, we have to actually not just talk the long-term investing talk. We need to walk the long-term investing walk. What does that mean? Well, to walk the long-term investing walk, we need to be willing to look at how our investing strategies are going to play out long-term. And that's rational investing. That's the whole idea. The whole idea of rational investing is to look at the historical data and see what the probabilities are of various outcomes if we follow various strategies. But if you do that, what you're going to find is that passive investing is a disaster. And that's the hurdle we can't get over, because every time we recommend that people look at the data, they say, wait a minute, the data says I'm doing something wrong, and I can't admit I'm doing something wrong. The experts told me it was the right thing to do. Well, the experts need to look at the data too. John Bogle needs to look at the data, and Bill Bernstein and Scott Burns and all these others. They all need to look at the data. They all need to return to common sense and give up this passive investing nonsense. How do we get there? That's not an intellectual hurdle. It's an emotional hurdle. And, you know, I talk about this thing, I call it X-ray vision. You know, X-ray vision is when you start looking at investing from a long-term perspective, all of the crazy things that passive investors say appear to your eyes. You see them as crazy. Whereas before, you just said, oh, an expert must be right. Duh, I do that. You know, that's dumb. You know, if the experts get something wrong, don't do it. If the experts tell you good stuff, do it. So when Bogle says focus on the long term, by all means, when Bogle tells you to index, by all means, embrace what he says. But when Bogle says to invest passively, you know, run. It's a new way of thinking about investing. It's a totally different head. That's the saying, you know, from the 60s. It's a totally different head. If you're going to be a long-term investor, you're going to have to give up all the things of short-term investing that you've become accustomed to, that you've come to think, that it becomes second nature to you. Now, there's a saying in the Bible, and I tend to misquote Bible sayings because I don't know my Bible very well. But I, you know, some of them you hear in the, you know, you hear them quote it. Where your treasure lies, there your heart will be also. Something along those lines. Where your treasure lies, there your heart will be also. And I think it says, you know, store your treasure in heaven. The idea is, you know, treasure heaven. And if you're thinking about heaven, that's going to affect your behavior. In Investo world, what that means is think about the benefits of long-term investing. Think about being able to retire early. That's how this all got started. I used to post at Retire Early boards. Think about how wonderful it would be to achieve financial freedom at age 60 instead of 65 or age 55 or age 50. We've got a calculator. John and I are working on a calculator, the buy and hold reality checker. And it's not finished, but I think we're getting close. I think we're going to have it up in a couple months. It's been a long effort, but and I'll close on this. But one of the checks I ran the other day is and there's different ways of doing it, so I can't give you one definitive result. But what I was trying to look at was, you know, as mentioned, on the scenario surfer, you almost always do better with valuation-informed indexing. It's a rare case where rebalancing provides a good result. But one of the things I did was I wanted to be able to make a claim, and I haven't done enough work to be able to make the claim, but I'm working up to it. How much? A lot of people are suffering. A lot of people feel bad today. They've lost so much money. Say you look at your portfolio, and over the 8 years from January 2000, well, it's 9 years I think now, from January 2000 till today, over those 9 years, we've lost 60%. The stock market has declined 60% in real terms, according to Shiller. So say that you had saved, that number doesn't include dividends, so it's not really a correct number. I use that number sometimes because I want to compare it. He's given the numbers on the earlier three times we went to insane price levels. We saw an average price drop of 68%. So I watch that to see if the 68% number is going to end up being right, or if we're going to have something bigger than the average loss or less. So I don't think that number is really a good number because it doesn't include dividends, but let's just use it. 60%. Say that you had saved $1 million and you were getting close to retirement, and now you're down to 400,000, 9 years later, and your retirement, instead of getting closer, it's getting farther away every year. You might feel sick to your stomach. A lot of people feel sick to their stomach. Or just look at the crash of the last year and say you had saved 400,000 and now you're down to 200,000. You lost $200,000. So you're saying $200,000, I can't stand to look. I hear a lot of people saying this. I can't stand to look at my portfolio statement. I can't stand to look at it. $200,000 is gone. Took me years to save 200,000. How can I ever emotionally cope with that? So I'm trying to think of ways to persuade people to switch to rational investing. And I want them, I think the psychological hurdle is, if I point out that they've lost the $200,000 because of this dumb mistake of believing that passive investing might work, it makes them feel pain. They say, I want to kick myself. It's too painful. So the cognitive dissonance kicks in, and they don't recognize it. I'm trying to get around that, sort of go past the radar, go past people's defenses and sort of sneak up on them with the realities. And one thought I have is, can I give people a promise about how to get that $200,000 back? Is there a way that I could say, if you switch to rational investing, you'll have the $200,000 back in X number of years? And obviously, you will do better with rational investing. There's no question. But the trouble, of course, is that rational investing does not pay off in a year. I can't say if you follow this approach, you're going to trounce the market over the next 24 months and you're going to get all your $200,000 back. It doesn't work that way. It's a long-term strategy, so it could well take 10 years or 20 years to get your money back. It's worth it. Those years are going to pass. They are going to pass. And you'll be far ahead if you follow a rational strategy. But telling you that you can do better in 20 years doesn't have the same marketing impact as telling you can do it in 24 months, you see. That's why short-term focus is so big. That's why passive investing is so popular, because it promises short-term benefits. Not nominally, they use the words long-term, but the appeal of it The marketing appeal is that it's just another short-term strategy. It's another get-rich-quick scheme, just like all the others that have failed. And because they dress it up in new language, it sounds prudent. You know, if you don't study it too deep, it sounds reasonable. So I want to make a pitch. I want to make a marketing pitch. I want my strategy to prevail. So marketing is part of the job. I just want it to be honest marketing. I've got to come up with a pitch that tells people, okay, is there a short-term, is there a way I can state the benefits, the long-term, the benefits are long-term of rational investing. Is there a way I can state it that makes it look like it has short-term appeal? And that's not dishonest. You know, I don't want to cheat people. I want it to be real. Well, the way I came up with this, I was using the reality checker, and I said, well, I can show here that in 30 years, valuation-informed indexing, you know, almost always wins. 90% of the time wins. So it's clearly superior. Is there a way I can translate that into short-term language? And what I came up with is I said, well, what if I compared two portfolios starting today, January of 2009, and the guy following valuation-informed indexing has $100,000 to invest. And the guy following rebalancing, following the passive investing approach, has $150,000 to invest. And then I go 30 years out and show where they're at. And I can show that 30 years out, they will have equal success. Because, see, valuation-informed indexing is superior. So in 30 years, it's always going to beat passive. It's always going to beat rebalancing, or 90% of the time it's going to beat it. So what I'm showing when I do that is switching to valuation-informed indexing today is equivalent to having $50,000 more to invest. Instead of having $100,000 to invest, you can get the same long-term result with $100,000 as the passive investor could get with $150,000. So it's like having 50% more money. It's like increasing the size of your portfolio by 50% overnight. You don't get the money in your account overnight. You know, that's the short-term focus. That's what people want. People want me to be able to say, yeah, Rob, put it in my account today. Make me feel better. I've lost tons of money. Put it in my account today. 50% increase. That I can't do. And I'm going to tell you I can't do it. But what I can do is I can tell you how to invest in such a way that it's the equivalent of having 50% larger portfolio than you have. So you can take a big red pen and cross out that bottom line on your portfolio statement and put in a number 50% higher. And it's real, not in the sense that the money's in the account today, but it's real in the sense that if you follow this strategy, the first truly long-term investing strategy that I know of. If you follow it, you'll end up in the same place as the passive investors will end up 30 years down the road. My hope is that that sort of argument will ease the pain for the people who have followed passive and are now suffering the effects. The point here is that, you know, what I'm trying, I'm using a marketing hat to sell the intellectual benefits of rational investing. I know that rational investing is better. I know that valuation-informed investing is better, but I'm having trouble marketing it because people want short-term results. They don't want long-term results. And passive has this huge edge because it's a short-term strategy. All the passive investors go to the discussion boards, and all they ever talk about is, when you tell them passive can't work, they say, I'm rich, man. I made all this money. Look at the money I made over the past 3 years. Money's flooding in, man. Short-term results of this strategy are awesome. They're awesome, man. And I'm saying, dude, they're not so totally awesome as you think. Long-term, they're not awesome. Long-term, passive investors get caught in stock crashes and they lose those gains. So it's not so totally awesome, dude. But I've got to come up with a way to you know, to at least make a marketing pitch in short-term terms for a long-term strategy, not with the goal of leading people to think that short-term thinking is what works, but with the goal of getting under the radar, getting people to, you know, if people didn't feel so bad about their losses, I think they'd be more open to more rational strategies. So the point of this podcast is when passive investing dogmatists criticize rational investing, what's usually going on is that they're stuck in their short-term mode of thinking. Bogle made a huge advance by turning the focus from the short-term to the long-term, or at least trying to, but he made a huge error by thinking that passive investing could work. And as a result, what we really have with passive investing is a short-term strategy and long-term clothing. And so you'll see criticisms that, yes, rational investors can predict stock crashes, but they can only do it 12 years in advance. They can't do it 12 months in advance. Think about what they're saying, and you'll see that the real criticism is they don't like rational investing because rational investing is the first true long-term investing strategy. It's not a new get-rich-quick scheme dressed up in long-term clothes. It's a true long-term investing strategy. And to get over the hump from the place we're in today, the investing crisis and the economic crisis we're living through today, to this magical, you know, it really is almost magical, this wonderful world of truly rational, truly effective, truly life-enhancing investing strategies, to get over that hump, we've somehow got to address the pain that passive investors are in today. And I hope to be able to do that by constructing some marketing pitches that sell long-term, sort of the opposite, you know, of what Bogle did. I don't think he did this intentionally, but Bogle took short-term strategies and dressed them up in long-term clothes. So I'm going to try to take long-term truly long-term strategies and dress them up in a short-term marketing pitch so that, you know, so that people actually start using this stuff, because it's not enough to have discovered to combine Buffett and Bogle and Shiller and come up with the best investing strategy known to mankind, which is, I think, what we have. That's not enough. You've got to sell it. And to sell it, we may have to use some short-term marketing pitches without being dishonest. But we may have to try to we've got to get through the radar. We've got to get through the pain. We've got to get people to see. And so if this fellow on this thread could just see, just think about what he's saying. What he's saying is that I did effectively predict the stock crash, but it's not good enough because I did it 12 years in advance, and he's only willing to listen if I do it 1 year in advance. Well, my message back to that fellow is, you got me. Can't do it 12 months in advance. Nailed me on that one, but I can do it 12 years in advance. If you're a long-term investor, that should be good enough. That's what leads to the huge gains that all rational investors, all valuation-informed indexers enjoy over the long term. If long-term investing is good enough for you, rational investing, valuation-informed indexing is truly the way to go. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.